Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. and J.A. Johnstone's A Rocky Mountain Christmas, narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Thomas Penny, Thomas Keegan, Colleen Delaney, Stephen Carpenter, Christopher Graybill, David Coyne, Johann Detweiler, Terrence Aselford, Michael John Casey, Joe Brack, Eric Mesner, Ren Casey, Lily Beacon, Michael Glenn, Evan Casey, Mort Shelby, Elizabeth Jernigan, Bradley Smith, Scott McCormick, Tim Getman, Ken Jackson, Christopher Shearer, Nick DePinto, Jeff Baker, Richard Rowan, Casey Platt, Faith Potts, Elliot Dash, Gary Tells, Danny Gavigan, James Konacek, Karen Novak, Dylan Lynch, Joel David Santner, Tim Pabone, Tim Carlin, Damian Richardson, Patrick Bussing, Drew Copas, Kimberly Gilbert, Dwayne Beeman, and Nanette Sabar. Lambert Airport, St. Louis, Missouri, December 20th, 1961. Rebecca Daniels Robeson awaited her flight in the comfort of the Admiral's Lounge. A huge Christmas tree sparkled with blinking lights and shining ornaments. Rebecca was reading from a newspaper when she was approached by a very attractive young woman.
Ambassador Robeson? My name is Margaret Chambers, and I'm a reporter for the St. Louis Globe-Democrat. I wonder if you would consent to an interview?
Why would you want to interview me, dear? I'm no longer an ambassador.
No, but you're still active on the international scene. And a recent poll put you as the country's most admired woman.
Nonsense, my dear. Eleanor Roosevelt is the most admired woman.
You came in second. And Mrs. Roosevelt doesn't count. She's been the most admired woman for the last 13 years.
And rightly so. She has certainly been most gracious to me over the years.
Attention, passengers. All flights are on temporary hold until the runways can be cleared of snow.
I was about to say that there wouldn't be time for an interview, but it appears that my flight has been delayed, so I would be happy to talk to you. I suppose you want to hear about my time as ambassador to Greece.
No, ma'am. I'm doing a story for our special Christmas edition. I understand that you once had a most harrowing Christmas experience when you were a child.
Harrowing? Yes, I suppose it was. Though that's not exactly the word I would use. But it was also the most uplifting experience of my life.
Could you share that story with our readers?
How much do you know about that incident?
Hardly anything. Just that you've been very reluctant to discuss it in all these years, and that you've turned down every request for it. Your father was a U.S. senator then, and...
A state senator in Colorado.
Yes, thank you. According to what little information exists, you and your family were on a train going from Pueblo to Red Cliff, Colorado during a blizzard.
That's correct, but that is only part of the story. If I told you everything, I'm afraid you would have a very difficult time believing it, which is why I have never told the story before.
Why don't you try me? I would love to hear the entire story.
Margaret, is it?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, since my plane is delayed, Margaret, I will tell you the whole story of that Christmas so long ago. But I'm 80 years old now, and I don't much care if people think I'm a crazy old lady or not. I guess now is as good a time as any to finally tell it.
Thank you, Ambassador Robeson.
Let's sit down, Margaret. And please, no questions until I'm done.
New Orleans, July 9th. 1889. The Delta Mist was moored to the bank, running parallel with Chapatula Street. Matt Jensen had shown his ticket to the purser, then boarded the vessel. Instead of going directly to his stateroom, Matt stood along the rail of the Texas deck, looking back toward the city of New Orleans. The captain of the boat was standing on the lower deck, frequently pulling out his pocket watch to check the time. It was obvious that he was waiting for someone, and whoever it was late, contributing to an increasing agitation. Then, Matt saw a cab approaching the river, the horse in a rapid trot. The cab pulled to a stop at the river's edge, and a woman got out, handed a bill to the driver, then hurried across the gangplank and onto the boat.
Uncle, I'm so sorry. I was shopping and I lost track of the time.
Jenny, I can't hold up the entire boat because my niece can't keep track of the time.
From here, Matt was able to examine the woman rather closely. She was an exceptionally pretty woman, with red hair, a peaches and cream complexion, blue eyes, and prominent cheekbones. If one had asked her about her lips, she might suggest that they were perhaps a bit too full.
Mr. Peabody, away all lines! Pull in the gangplank!
Matt maintained his position at the rail on the Texas deck, watching as the boat crew performed the ordered tasks. Captain Lee had by now reached the wheelhouse, and once the boat was free of its restraints, a signal was sent to the engine room. The stern wheel began to turn, pushing the boat away from the dock and out into the middle of the Mississippi River. They turned upstream, and the great red and yellow paddle wheel began spinning rapidly, leaving behind the boat a long, frothing wake. Off Memphis, July 11th, 1889. Jenny Lee worked for her uncle as a hostess in the Grand Salon of the Delta Mist, a packet boat that made the run between St. Louis and New Orleans. Jenny was passing pleasantries with some of the passengers.
No man is that lucky. You have to be cheating.
The speaker was standing at one of the tables, and the object of his anger and the subject of his charge was Matt Jensen.
Mister, nobody cheats me and gets away with it.
You're out of line, Holman.
Jay Miller was a lawyer from St. Louis.
Nobody has been cheating at this table.
Hell, there ain't nobody been cheating. I ain't won a hand in the last hour. And he's won most of them. I'm just gonna take this pot to make up for it.
That's not your pot.
Yeah? Well, we'll just see whose pot it is.
Leave the money on the table, Holman.
The hell I will, Jensen. This money is mine and I'm taking it with me.
Jenny hurried over to the table.
Mr. Holman, please. You are creating a disturbance and your behavior is making the passengers uneasy.
Yeah? Well, to hell with the passengers. What kind of boat is this, anyway, that you allow cheaters in the games?
I wasn't cheating.
Mr. Jensen is telling the truth, Miss Lee. He wasn't cheating.
These gentlemen don't agree with you.
Well, of course they don't. They're probably in on it. I won't be surprised if they didn't all get together later and divide up the money. My money! And like I said, I'll be taking this pot.
Mr. Holman, when you play cards for money, you are accepting the possibility of losing. The only thing that protects the game is honesty, integrity, and the honor of the players.
You're in it too, aren't you? You're all in it together.
Look, we were in the same game as you. You think we would take up for him if he was cheating? Hell, we lost money too.
Yeah, well, neither of you lost as much money as I did.
It's because neither of them is as bad as cards as you are.
What do you mean I'm a bad player? Why, I'm as good at cards as any man.
No, you aren't. You can't run a bluff. You raise bets and games a stud when the cards you have show and prove you're beaten. You should find some other game a chance and give up poker.
Mr. Jensen, I believe the pot is yours.
Jenny reached for the money to slide it across the table toward Matt, but Holman pushed her back away from the table so hard that she fell.
Keep your hands off my money. Like I said, I'm taking this pot, and there's nobody here who can stop me.
Matt helped Jenny get up.
Thank you for interceding, Miss Lee. I think you'd better let me handle this now.
You're gonna handle this? What do you plan to do?
Whatever it takes.
Holman stepped away from the table and flipped his jacket back, showing an ivory-handled pistol in a tooled leather holster.
Mister, maybe it's time that I tell you who I am. My name ain't John Holman like I've been saying. My actual name is Quince Justin Holmes. Only some folks call me Quick Justice Holmes because I tend to make my own justice, if you know what I mean. What do you say now?
I say the same thing I've been saying. You aren't getting that pot.
It won't matter none to you whether I get the pot or not, because you ain't gonna be around to see it.
Does this mean you're inviting me to the dance?
Yeah, you might say that. I'll even let you make the first move.
Despite his offer, Holman's hand was already dipping for his pistol even as he was speaking. He smiled as he realized that his draw had caught Matt by surprise. But the smile left his face when he saw Matt's draw.
I'll be damned.
You could have prevented it at any time.
Matt returned his pistol to his holster. Looking over toward Jenny, he saw a horrified expression on her face.
I'm sorry about this, Miss Lee.
No, you had no choice.
At sea, September 23rd, 1890. The ship was the American Eagle, a four-masted clipper in the Pacific trade. As much canvas as could be spread gleamed a brilliant white in the sunshine, and the ship was lifting, falling, and rolling from side to side as it plowed over the long, rolling swells of the Pacific. The ship was heeling from the wind, and Luke Chardine, the first officer, was standing on the leeward side on the quarter deck, his hands resting lightly on the railing. He examined the barometer for the third time in the last 30 minutes. There was no doubt that it was falling, and that could only presage bad weather. Leaving the quarterdeck, he tapped on the door of the captain's cabin.
Yes?
Captain, permission to enter?
Come in, Mr. Chardine.
Captain Cutter was bent over the chart table with a compass and protractor.
Captain, the barometer has fallen rather significantly in the last half hour. I've no doubt but a storm is coming.
Do you have any idea how fast we're going, Mr. Chardine?
It would only be a guess.
We're doing 19 knots, Mr. Chardine. 19 knots. It's my belief that if we can maintain this pace, we'll outrun the storm.
We won't be able to maintain this pace, Captain, if we rig the storm sails.
I have no intention of rigging the storm sails. Certainly not until it's an absolute necessity.
Very good, Captain.
Luke withdrew from the captain's cabin, Captain Cutter following behind him. Luke looked out over the water. The sea was no longer blue, but dirty gray and swirling with white caps.
Captain, we have to strike sail.
Aye, do so.
Luke sent men aloft to strike sail, praying that no one would be tossed off by the bucking ship. They managed to strip the masts of all canvas without losing anyone, but the storm continued to build until by mid-morning, it was a full-blown typhoon.
Captain, we have to head her into the wind!
No! Even without sail, we're still making headway.
If we don't do it, we'll likely lose the ship!
I'm the captain of this vessel, Mr. Chardine, and as long as I am captain, we'll sail the course I've set for her.
Aye, aye, sir!
The huge waves continued to crash against the side of the ship, and the rolling steepened. The yardarms were free of sail except for the spanker sail, which had been left rigged and was now no more than tattered strips of canvas, flapping ineffectively in the 90-mile-per-hour wind. Captain Cutter was standing on the quarterdeck when a huge wave burst over the side of the ship. The captain and three sailors were swept off the deck into the sea.
Captain overboard! Helmsman, turn into the wind!
That kept them in place and stopped the terrible rolling of the ship, which began to pitch up, then down by 45 degrees. Luke put the men to the rails to search for those who had been washed overboard. They found and recovered two of the sailors, but there was no sign of the third sailor, or the captain. By late afternoon, the storm had abated, and Luke ordered the ship to remain in place to continue the search. For the next 2 days, in calm winds and a placid sea, they searched for the captain and the missing sailor. But they found no sign of either of them. Finally, Luke ordered the ship to continue on its original course. They raised San Francisco 23 days later. Luke sat in the office of Richard Buckner, the owner of the Pacific Shipping Company. Although Richard Buckner had become a millionaire from his shipping empire, he had never been to sea. Nevertheless, his office was a nautical showplace, replete with model ships, polished bells engraved with the names of the ships from which they came, and the complete reconstruction of a helm with wheel and compass. Buckner was a man of average height, but in comparison to Luke Chardine's 6'4" frame, he seemed short.
Mr. Chardine, you ought to be congratulated, sir, for an excellent job of bringing the ship back safely. Please tell me what happened.
Luke told him about the storm and how a huge wave hit him broadside, washing over the captain and 3 other sailors. Luke made no mention of the argument he had with Captain Cutter about bringing the ship into the wind.
We rescued 2 of the sailors right away, and we stayed on station for 2 days, but we never found Captain Cutter or Seaman Bostick.
Thank you. I'm sure that Mrs. Cutter will be comforted to know exactly what happened, and will be grateful for the effort the entire ship showed in trying to rescue her husband.
I wish we'd been successful.
Yes, well, such things are in the hands of God. Now, Mr. Chardine, if you would, there are some reports we will need for you to fill out, and after you are done with the reports, please come back into the office. I have something I want to discuss with you.
Aye, sir.
As he was filling out the reports, Luke was given a stack of letters that had been held for him until the ship's return. One of them was from a lawyer's office in Pueblo, Colorado. Luke had never been to Pueblo, Colorado, and as far as he was aware, he didn't know anyone there.
Dear Mr. Chardine, it is with sadness that I report to you the death of your uncle Frank Luke, who passed away on the 5th of August from an infirmity of the heart. As you were his only living relative, you are the sole beneficiary of his will, in which he leaves you the following items: 18,000 acres of land, a 4-room house, all the furniture therein, a bunkhouse, a barn, 1,500 head of cattle, 20 horses with saddles and tack, $1,017.56 remaining after final expenses. In order to claim your inheritance, you must present yourself at the Pueblo Courthouse on or before November 1st, 1890. Sincerely, Tom Murchison, Attorney at Law.
The letter came as a complete surprise. He had not seen his Uncle Frank in over 10 years and had no idea that he lived in Colorado, or that he even had anything valuable enough to leave in a will. And here Uncle Frank left everything to him. He felt conflicting emotions of elation and guilt. Elation over what appeared to be a rather substantial inheritance, and guilt because he had not only not seen his Uncle Frank in the last 10 years, he had only corresponded with him 3 or 4 times in all that time. When he was finished with the paperwork, he returned to Mr. Buckner's office as requested.
Mr. Chardine, with the unfortunate death of Captain Cutter, we are going to have to find a new captain for the American Eagle. You know the ship and the men, and you brought her successfully through a terrible storm. I would like for you to be her new captain.
I thank you for the offer, Mr. Buckner. I am extremely flattered by it. But I believe I will leave the sea for a while. I'll be submitting my resignation today.
What? Why, you can't be serious. Mr. Chardine, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. How can you possibly pass it up?
Simple. Until today, I had no anchor. But now, I am a man of property, and I can no longer afford to sail all over the world.
Are you absolutely positive of that? Because if you are, then we will have to promote someone else to captain.
I am positive.
Very well. The company will hate to lose you, Mr. Chardine. You have been a good officer. If ever you wish to return to the sea, please come see us first.
I will do so.
The Delta Mist, October 5th, 1890. As hostess on board the Delta Mist, it was Jenny's duty to see to the comfort and needs of the passengers who came into the Grand Salon. She also arranged friendly games of whist, checkers, and even poker for the passengers who wanted to participate. One of the passengers who was interested in getting into a game of poker was Nate McCoy. McCoy dressed well. He had impeccable manners, and he seemed to be able to get along with everyone. He was also the most handsome man Jenny had ever seen. Jenny watched him as he played poker, though she stood on the far side of the salon so that nobody could see that she was watching him. Then, one evening as she was standing on the Texas deck looking down at the great stern wheel, its paddles spilling water as they emerged from the river, a man spoke to her.
"You have been watching me."
Turning toward the speaker, Jenny saw Nate McCoy.
"I'm supposed to watch people in the salon. That is my job."
"You're not watching me as part of your job. You're watching me for the same reason I'm watching you."
"Oh? And why is that?"
"I think you know why that is."
Jenny was lost from that moment, falling head over heels in love with him. 3 months later, they were married. Jenny learned quickly that marrying Nate McCoy was the biggest mistake she had ever made. Although McCoy told her that he was a broker who dealt with other people's money, that was an extremely broad interpretation of his actual profession. McCoy was a professional gambler, and he was not an honest one. Caught cheating on the Delta Mist, McCoy was barred from taking passage on that or any of the passenger boats that plied the Mississippi. When he left the boats, Jenny left with him. And for the next 18 months, her life with McCoy became little more than running from town to town just ahead of a lynch mob.
"Why do you cheat?"
"Why do I cheat? Isn't it obvious? I cheat to make money. Where do you think we get the food we eat? The expensive clothes you wear? How do we pay for the fine hotel rooms? From my winnings, that's where. The odds of winning are not good enough to do all that unless I give myself an edge, and that is exactly what I do, my dear. I give myself an edge."
"By cheating?"
"You call it cheating. I call it increasing the odds."
"When you were caught cheating on the boats, the only thing that happened was that you were barred from taking any further passage on them. But if you were caught cheating in a saloon or a gambling house, the consequences could be much more severe. You could be killed."
"Oh, it does my heart good to know that my darling wife is frightened for me."
"Nate, why don't we make a living doing something else? I have an education. I could teach school."
"And assuming you could get around the obstacle of being married, what would you propose that I do, my dear? Become a store clerk, perhaps?"
"Why not? It would be honest work, and we could settle down somewhere and have a real home like ordinary people."
"Like ordinary people?"
"Yes."
"And this real home, no doubt it will have a white picket fence, perhaps some flowers that you care for so tenderly, maybe even a brat or two running around?"
I wouldn't call them brats."
"Yes, well, my dear, as for your rather tedious dream, I am not ordinary, as you well know."
"Yes, how well I know."
2 days after that very conversation, Jenny was in their hotel room in Colorado Springs, Colorado. McCoy had been gone for over 4 hours now, and it was not like him to be gone for so long. He had told her when he left this morning that he would have lunch with her, but it was nearly 1 o'clock and he hadn't come back to the hotel room yet. Feeling an overwhelming sense of foreboding, Jenny walked over to the window and stood there, looking down onto the street below. With trembling hands, Jenny crossed over to open the door. The man standing in the hallway was wearing the badge of a deputy city marshal.
"Mrs. McCoy?"
"Is he dead?"
"Yes, ma'am. I'm afraid he is."
"What happened?"
I'm told that he was caught with an ace up his sleeve. There was an altercation. Your husband went for a gun, and he was shot dead.
That is impossible.
Mrs. McCoy, are you saying your husband didn't cheat?
No, he cheated all right. But it isn't possible that he went for a gun, because he never carried one.
To be truthful with you, Mrs. McCoy, it doesn't matter whether he had a gun or not. There was a bitter argument precipitated by your husband, and the man who shot him believed that McCoy was going for a gun. That belief that his life was threatened is all it takes to justify shooting your husband.
Where is he now?
The undertaker has him. Will you be paying for his final expenses, or will the city pay?
You mean the city would pay?
A plain pine box and a hole in the ground. I'm afraid there is nothing comforting about a city-financed burying.
I'll go see the undertaker. Perhaps we can come to an accommodation of sorts.
Though the news came suddenly, Jenny couldn't honestly say that she was surprised by this turn of events. Deep down, she'd been expecting something like this to happen for quite a while. She went to the undertaker's office and made arrangements for her husband to be buried in the churchyard. To pay for the service, she used the money he had made from the same venture that ended up getting him killed. The committal service was short, consisting only of a single prayer, during which the preacher called him Ned instead of Nate. The moment the preacher said amen, the gravedigger came over and he and the mortician lowered the pine box into the ground. Jenny stood sentinel until the last shovelful of dirt entombed her husband. Then she went to the railroad station, having no reason to stay in Colorado Springs. She ended up buying a ticket going to Pueblo, Colorado. She didn't really know why she chose Pueblo. Mostly because it was somewhere other than where she was. Pueblo, Colorado, April 1892. After coming to Pueblo, Jenny had found that she had a real penchant for teaching, and she ended up becoming the town's elementary teacher. She found that the job left her feeling more fulfilled than she had ever felt in her life as Nate McCoy's wife. One day, while the children played in the schoolyard, the principal and superintendent came into her classroom.
Mr. Gray? Mr. Twitty?
Miss McCoy. Or should I say, Mrs. McCoy?
The expression on Mr. Gray's face was grim.
I'm not married. I'm a widow.
You were married to Nate McCoy, were you not?
Yes, I was.
It has come to our attention that Nate McCoy was a gambler of, let us say, questionable ethics. And while you were married, you followed him from gambling den to gambling den. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm sorry to have to tell you this, Mrs. McCoy, but the school board has asked for your dismissal.
On what grounds?
Moral turpitude.
What? But I...
Please take your things and leave.
My class?
They are no longer your class. We have already hired a replacement teacher.
Can't I at least finish the year? We've only got 1 month to go. For the children's sake, don't you think it would be better for them to keep the same teacher until the end of the year?
Goodbye, Mrs. McCoy.
Red Cliff, Colorado, July 8th, 1892. The sign on the front of the store read, Rafferty's Grocery Store. Michael Santelli stepped into the little store at about 2 p.m.
Yes, sir, what can I do for you?
Mr. Rafferty was behind the counter, and Mrs. Rafferty was sweeping the floor. She looked up and smiled. Santelli took a quick glance around, and seeing nobody else in the store, he pulled his gun and pointed it at Rafferty.
You can give me all your money. That's what you can do for me.
Yes, sir. Just don't be getting trigger happy there.
Rafferty opened his cash drawer, took out $30, and handed it across the counter.
What is this?
You said to give you all my money. That's what I did. This is all the money I have.
$30? Do you expect me to believe that all you have is $30?
That's all I have. We deposited yesterday's receipts in the bank last night. I always start in the morning with just enough money to make change.
You're lying. You better come up with some more money fast.
Please, I don't have any more money.
I warned you.
Shut up!
Santelli went around behind the counter and looked through the cash box. Rafferty had been telling the truth.
Damn!
With no more than the $30 Rafferty had given him in the first place, Santelli left the store and the town of Pueblo. 1 week later, Michael Santelli rode into the town of Kiowa, Colorado, sizing it up as he did so. The little town was made up of whipsawed lumber shacks with unpainted, splitting wood that was turning gray in the sun. There was one rather substantial-looking brick building with a sign over the door that identified it as the Bank of Kiowa. Still angered by the slim pickings from Rafferty's grocery store, Santelli figured the bank might offer some promise for a bigger payoff. He already had over $5,000 that he had taken from a bank in Greeley. He had hidden the money in the bottom of an old abandoned well near Gunnison. It was his plan to put together enough money to go down to Texas and buy a saloon. What Santelli didn't realize was that Bert Rowe, a friend of Rafferty, had been in the back of the store and had not only seen everything, but he had recognized him. As a result, the word had gone out to every sheriff, city marshal, and town constable in Colorado. Santelli rode up to the hitching rail in front of the Silver Nugget Saloon.
Yeah.
The saloon was busy, but Santelli found a place at the head of the bar.
Beer.
He immediately began to formulate a plan for robbing the bank. Matt Jensen was standing at the opposite end of the bar with both hands wrapped around a mug of beer. He studied the man in the mirror and saw that he was average height and weight with unkempt black hair. He had dark obsidian eyes and a purple scar that started just below his left eye and disappeared into a scraggly beard. It was the scar that helped Matt make the identification. Matt had seen drawings and read descriptions of the outlaw Michael Santelli. But before he could make any move toward Santelli, Matt saw the deputy sheriff come into the room. He decided to wait and see how this played out.
Santelli! You are Santelli, aren't you? Michael Santelli?
Santelli looked up, studying the lawman's reflection in the mirror, but he didn't turn around.
Lawman, I'm afraid you've got me mixed up with somebody else.
No, I don't think so. I know who you are. You're a bank robber and a murderer, and you're under arrest.
Well, it looks like I can't fool you, can I? What are you anyway, a city marshal, a sheriff?
I'm a deputy sheriff. Mason's the name.
Well now, Deputy Mason, you think you've got yourself a big prize, don't you? Well, you're right. I am Michael Santelli. But there's not a thing you're going to be able to do about it. Because the truth is, mister, you've just bitten off more than you can chew. And if you make a move toward your gun, I'll kill you where you stand.
And then I'll kill you.
Santelli was startled to hear a new challenge, and he turned his head quickly to see Matt standing away from the bar, facing him. Like Mason and Santelli, Matt had not drawn his pistol.
Who asked you to butt into this?
Nobody asked me. But I met Deputy Mason earlier today, and I found him to be a fine, upstanding gentleman. And I plan to stand here and watch you shoot him.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. I appreciate your help.
Well, Jensen? Is that your name?
Matt Jensen, yeah.
You fellas seem to have me at a disadvantage. Two of you, my one.
I would say it's a smart observation, Santelli.
Take your gun out of your holster, using only your thumb and finger.
Santelli went for his pistol. Matt made a lightning draw of his pistol. Knowing that he was beaten, Santelli jerked his hand away from his gun and held it empty out in front of him.
No, I ain't gonna draw.
holding his left hand up in the air now as a signal of surrender. Santelli's right hand removed his pistol from the holster, using his thumb and forefinger.
Now, lay your pistol on the floor and kick it over here.
I'll help you march him down to jail.
Thanks.
Jensen, I have a feeling that me and you are going to meet again someday.
Pueblo, August 4th, 1892. Jenny was getting desperate. She had not been able to find a job, and she was nearly out of money. At the door, Jenny saw a very pretty and elegant-looking woman in her early 50s. Jenny recognized her. This was Adele Summers, the proprietor of the Colorado Social Club. The Colorado Social Club, Jenny knew, was a house of prostitution.
Miss Summers, what can I do for you?
I hope it's something I can do for you. I've heard of your problem and how the school board, the bunch of ninnies, got you fired. I would like for you to come work for me, and I will pay you 3 times more money than you were making teaching school.
Oh, Miss Summers, I thank you. I really do. But I don't think I could do something like...
Hear me out before you reply. It isn't what you think.
Oh?
I'm not asking you to be a prostitute. Not for a minute. May I come in?
Of course.
I don't know what you know about the social club, but it isn't your ordinary house of prostitution. We have a very high-class clientele. All I would want from you is that you meet our clients when they arrive. And for those clients who would enjoy such a thing, spend a little time with them, talking to them, having a drink with them, and making them feel welcome. That's all.
You mean you want me to be a hostess?
Yes! Yes, that is exactly what you would be. You would be a hostess and nothing more.
Kiowa, Colorado, November 11th, 1892. A rather short, beady-eyed looking man with a red, splotchy face and thin blonde hair entered inside the Kiowa jail. 2 deputies sat in one corner of the room, and there was a man sitting behind a desk in the far corner of the room. The sign on his desk read, Adam Carter, Sheriff, Elbert County.
Can I help you?
You got my brother in jail. I want to visit him.
What's your name?
Ward, Bob Ward.
We don't have anyone by that name in jail.
You got Michael Santella here, don't you?
Yeah.
That's my brother.
Your brother?
We got the same mother. We don't got the same father.
Isn't there some paper out on you, Ward?
Not anymore, Sheriff. I was let out of prison 2 months ago. You can check.
All right. You can go in and see your brother. But first, take your pistol belt off and lay it on the desk.
Ward did as directed.
I'll give you 30 minutes. Come on.
Sheriff Carter pointed Ward back to the cell area and closed the door. That left Ward and Santelli alone.
Well, so my brother's come to see me. I'm touched.
They tell me you're gonna hang.
That's what the judge said at my trial.
And so, look, I was thinking, if you're gonna hang anyway, why don't you just tell me where that money is that you took from the bank in Mirage?
What makes you think I've got any of that money left?
I know you do. I just don't know how much.
It's a little over $5,000. I was planning on getting enough money to go to Texas and buy a saloon.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It's too bad you can't do it now. So look, why don't you tell me where the money is and I'll buy a saloon and I'll name it after you.
What do you mean you'll name it after me?
Well, you'll be dead. So it's only right that if I buy a saloon with your money that I name it after you.
What makes you think you're gonna have my money?
Well, why not, Michael? Like I said, you'll be dead. What good is that money gonna do you when you're dead? You may as well tell me where it is. Because when you think about it, me and you's the only kin either one of us has.
You get me out of here, and I'll tell you where the money is.
How am I supposed to do that? There's only one way out of this building. It's through the front door. There's a sheriff and 2 deputies up there with guns, and maybe you didn't notice, but they took my gun away from me before they would let me come back here.
They're taking me to Red Cliff to hang. That's a long way by train. If
Figure out some way to get me off the train.
I don't think I can do that by myself. It's going to take 3 or 4 people to do something like that.
Then hire them. Promise them $500 each. That'll leave $3,000 for me and you to split half and half.
$1,500 sure ain't like $5,000.
How much money do you have now?
I don't know. About $40, I reckon.
$1,500 is a lot more than $40.
Yeah, I guess you're right. All right. I'll find some people to help me. Listen, just in case something goes wrong, don't you think you ought to tell me where that money is? I mean, just in case.
It's up to you to make certain nothing goes wrong.
I got a friend that I was in the pen with. I'll get him to help.
Yeah, you do that.
Pueblo, Tuesday, November 15th, 1892. Luke Chardine was 27 years old. His hair was dark and his eyes were brown, overlaid with a gold matrix. He was 6'4" tall, with broad shoulders, powerful arms, and big hands. From the age of 17 until he was 26, he had been at sea, rising from an able-bodied seaman to first officer. 3 years ago, after inheriting some land from his father's brother, he left the sea and came to Colorado to work his ranch. At this very moment, Luke was in the model barber shop, sitting in the chair. He stroked his chin and examined his face in the mirror.
Ooh, would you like a nice-smelling aftershave tonic? The women all love it.
I have enough trouble keeping women away from me now. Why would I want more coming around?
Yes, indeed, sir. I suppose a handsome fellow like yourself would have to put up with a lot of women. It must be quite a burden.
Now, who's pulling whose leg here?
The barber took his payment, then looked around to make certain he wasn't overheard.
Ooh, have you seen the new young lady over at the social club?
I'm not one who visits such places. I'm not judgmental of those who do, you understand, but I'm not interested in a woman who'll go to bed with anyone who meets her price.
Oh, you don't understand. This new girl isn't like that. She used to be a school teacher, and they say she's very smart. She's also very pretty.
So she's smarter and prettier than all the others. I still don't plan to pay her to let me take her to bed.
Oh, I don't think you could pay this girl enough to get her in bed.
What are you talking about? Does she work for the social club or not?
Oh, yeah, she works there, but the only thing you can do with her is have a nice conversation. Oh, and maybe have a cup of coffee and some cookies. She's what they call a hostess. All she does is talk and smile.
Do people who go to the club know that?
Oh, yeah, they know that. And she's still the most popular girl there.
How can that be, if she doesn't allow them to do anything?
It's because, like I said, she's one of the prettiest women you'll ever see, and also the smartest. She has a way of talking with you that makes you feel like you're just as smart as she is.
You talk like you know this firsthand.
Oh, I do know it firsthand. I'll tell you true, I never thought I'd ever go to a place like the social club and not do anything but talk. But that's exactly what I've done, and I've done it more than once.
Luke decided to pay a visit to the social club. He was met by a smiling, middle-aged, attractive woman.
Why, Mr. Chardine, how nice of you to visit us.
You know me?
Oh, yes. You own 2 Crowns Ranch, and you have the reputation of being a real gentleman. My name is Adele, and I make it a point to know all of the, well, let us say, quality gentlemen of Pueblo. What can I do for you?
Well, the truth is, this is all rather new for me, so I'm not sure exactly what to do.
It's simple enough. I'll take you into our lounge, where you'll see some of our young ladies. All you have to do is pick out one which interests you and...
No, not that.
Then, I don't understand, Mr. Chardine. What do you want?
Nothing, I guess. I'm sorry I wasted your time. Please forgive me.
Oh, you didn't waste my time at all, Mr. Chardine. It was a pleasure talking to you. Please come visit us again sometime.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll just go now.
Luke hurried out the front door just as Jenny came into the foyer.
Who was that?
That was Luke Chardine.
What did he want?
I don't have the slightest idea. And what's more, I don't think he does either.
When Luke stopped by the post office to pick up his mail, he saw that he had a letter from Heckmeyer and Sons, a cattle brokerage company in the nearby town of Greenhorn. Anxiously, he opened the letter, hoping it was the answer he was looking for.
Mr. Chardine, our company would be pleased to buy 500 head of cattle from you at the prevailing market price. Payment will be made upon delivery of the cattle. Sincerely, Anthony Heckmeyer, broker.
Greenhorn, Colorado, November 22nd, 1892. Early this morning, Luke had shipped 500 head of Hereford cattle by rail to Greenhorn, paying $5 per head for shipping costs. The railroad had offloaded the cattle into a railroad holding pen where they would keep them without charge for one day. Luke was told that if he made the sale, Heckmeyer and Sons would move the cattle from the pen.
I tried to get you $42.50, but the best offer I've been able to come up with for you is $40 a head. That would be $20,000 for 150 head.
Good. I was prepared to sell for $35 a head. The $5 increase paid for shipping them over here.
Well then, we'll both be happy. And you will be able to tell others of the wonderful service provided you by Heckmeyer and Sons.
Yes, sir. I'll be glad to do that, Mr. Heckmeyer.
Half an hour later, after Luke made a few small purchases at the local stores, Luke started home.
Tell me, Harry, how does it feel to be ridden by a rich man? All right, Harry, all right. I'm not really what you would call rich. But I'll have you know that I'm carrying more money than I have ever held in my hands my entire life.
Luke noticed that there were two horsemen on the road ahead of him. Acutely aware of his environment because of the money he was carrying, Luke decided not to overtake them, but to keep them in sight. That worked well for the first 15 minutes, and when he reached the top of the next rise, he expected to see them still on the road just ahead. But they weren't there, and despite a very careful perusal, they were still nowhere to be seen. Pulling his pistol, Luke checked the loads in the cylinder chambers, and satisfying himself that he was ready for any contingency, he returned the gun to the holster and rode ahead. Then, through a break in the trees, he saw two mounted men waiting just off the side of the road. Concerned that they might be setting up an ambush for him, he drew his pistol again. When the two riders suddenly thrust themselves in the road in front of him, Luke was ready for them. Both men were wearing hoods over their faces, only their eyes visible through the two eye holes.
Throw down your money!
The hell I will!
Luke's gun was dead on target. The other rider, suddenly realizing that he no longer had a 2-to-1 advantage, jerked his horse around and dug in the spurs. Luke holstered his pistol and snaked his rifle from the saddle sheath. The rider was running away from him as quickly as he could, and Luke couldn't bring himself to shoot a man in the back. So carefully, he eased the hammer back down and lowered the rifle. Dismounting, Luke walked over to the man he had shot and saw that he was dead. Luke pulled the hood off and tossed it to one side. He studied the man's face, but didn't recognize him. The road agent's horse had not run off, so with some effort, Luke put the dead man belly down over the saddle of the horse he had been riding. He thought about going back to Greenhorn, but by now he was almost as close to Pueblo, so he decided to take him there. When Luke rode up to the sheriff's office in Pueblo half an hour later, he was greeted by Deputy Sheriff Proxmire, who met him out in front of the office.
Who you got there, Luke?
To tell you the truth, Deputy, I don't know who this man is, but this fella and another man tried to rob me.
Tried to rob you, you say?
Yeah. I saw them ahead of me, saw them hiding behind some trees, so I got a little suspicious. I pulled my gun out, and when they ordered me to give them my money, I shot one of them. This one.
And what about the other man?
When I shot this fella, the other one turned and rode off. I could have shot him too, but I don't have the stomach to shoot someone in the back. Anyway, I thought I may as well bring this one to you.
Sheriff Farrell, you want to come out now?
The door to the sheriff's office opened behind Proxmire, and another man stepped out. Luke was surprised to see him, because he believed this was the man who had gotten away from him. He was also surprised to see that this man was wearing a star on his vest. There had been no star before.
Deputy, I'm not sure, but I think this may have been the other man.
By other man, you mean he was the man you shot?
Yeah. He had his face covered with a hood, so I can't be positive. But he was about this size, and he was wearing the same kind of clothes. Only he wasn't packing a star when I saw him last.
You say they were both wearing hoods?
Yeah.
What about the hood was on this fella? Have you got it with you?
No, I just tossed it aside.
What about you, Sheriff? Is this a man you encountered on the road?
It is indeed.
And you heard him, Sheriff? He confessed to murdering Deputy Gates.
What? What are you talking about? I didn't murder anyone.
Did you or did you not shoot down my deputy?
Who are you?
I'm Sheriff Farrell.
Damn right. Did you shoot this deputy, Luke?
Luke pointed to the body that was still draped across the horse behind him.
If that man is this man's deputy, then yeah, I shot him. But it was in self-defense, because whether this man is a sheriff or not, he and the man I shot tried to hold me up.
We did no such a thing. We were merely trying to stop him so we could ask him a few questions. That's when he surprised the two of us by shooting.
I don't know what's going on here, but what happened is nothing like this man is saying. Both men were wearing hoods over their faces, and they demanded that I give them my money. You don't mask yourself with a hood if all you want to do is ask a few questions, do you?
You say we were wearing hoods? But you can't show the hood my deputy was wearing.
If the man who you said tried to rob you was masked, how do you know this is the same man?
He just said that he was.
I'm gonna have to take your gun and hold you in jail till this is all worked out.
Deputy Sheriff, I'm telling you, these two men tried to rob me.
Why would they try to rob you, Luke? Do you carry so much money around all the time that someone would want to rob you?
I am now. I'm carrying almost $20,000 from the sale of my cattle. You can check with Heckmeyer and Sons over in Greenhorn. They will verify that I'm telling the truth.
Oh, I don't doubt that you sold some cows, but that's not the question. The question is, did the sheriff and his deputy stop to ask a few questions as he says, or did he and his deputy actually try to rob you?
They tried to rob me!
Look at it this way, Luke. Right now, it's your word against Sheriff Farrell's word. And seeing as he's an officer of the law, his word carries a bit more weight. But perhaps he can convince a jury to believe you.
A jury? Look here, are you actually telling me this is going to court?
It is.
Will he be in court?
I'll be there. I intend to see justice done for the killing of my deputy.
All right. I won't argue with you, Proxmire. If you'll let me put this money in the bank, I'll come quietly and I'll stand trial.
Good idea.
Judge Amon Briggs sat back in the chair in his chambers and put his hands together, fingertip to fingertip. He was listening to Sheriff Clay Farrell.
Luke can make a lot of trouble for us if we don't take care of this situation.
What do you mean trouble for us? I didn't attempt to hold him up.
Did you or did you not give Gates and me the information about him going to sell his cows? And were you or were you not going to be in for a third of the take? And that isn't the only deal we've been in. The coach holed up 2 months ago. You got your share from that, too, as I'm sure you will remember.
All right, there's no need to say anything else. The walls have ears. Don't worry, I'll take care of it.
Well, you'd better take care of it. Otherwise, we'll both be in trouble.
Pueblo, December 5th, 1892. Because Pueblo was the county seat, Luke's trial was going to be held in the local courthouse with Judge Amon Briggs presiding.
I want him tried for first-degree murder.
Briggs spoke to the prosecutor, Lloyd Gilmore.
Your Honor, I don't think I can make the case for first-degree murder. I mean, even if what the sheriff says is true, if all he and his deputy were doing was confronting him for questioning, it still wouldn't be premeditated murder.
It doesn't have to be premeditated. He was resisting arrest, and that is a felony. Any death that occurs during the commission of a felony is automatically first-degree murder.
According to Sheriff Farrell's own testimony, he wasn't making an arrest. He merely wanted to question him. That's not resisting arrest. A good lawyer could say that Luke thought he was being held up. And Tom Murchison is a good lawyer.
You're the prosecutor. It's your job to make hard cases against good lawyers.
All right. I'll try. But I don't think I'll be able to convince a jury.
As Prosecutor Gilmore and Judge Briggs were discussing the case, Tom Murchison arrived at the jail to meet with Luke Chardine. Tom Murchison had been the lawyer who handled the estate of Luke's Uncle Fred, the one who had left him the ranch. Since Luke's arrival in Pueblo, he and Murchison had become good friends.
Tell me what happened.
Luke told of selling the cows, then seeing the two men waiting in ambush for him. He told how they braced him with drawn guns and demanded that he give him his money.
I'll do what I can for you, Luke. The truth is, we are playing against a stacked deck. Judge Briggs seems to have an unusual connection to Sheriff Farrell. But you've never been in trouble since you've been here. You made a lot of friends, and I have an affidavit showing you sold your cattle for $20,000. So while our case will be difficult because the deck is stacked, well, theirs will be equally difficult because they have no motive.
Luke's trial was held the very next day. The prosecuting attorney presented his opening remarks.
Your Honor and gentlemen of the jury, Mr. Murchison will no doubt claim that Luke had no motive for killing Deputy Bates. And he will attempt to use that as proof that what happened wasn't murder. But Sheriff Farrell and Deputy Bates were conducting an investigation, and all they wanted to do was ask Luke a few questions. Luke shot and killed Bates, and Sheriff Farrell barely escaped with his life. If an officer of the law cannot question a citizen without getting shot, then where does that leave the rest of us?
Murchison had been making notes, and when Gilmore sat down, Murchison walked over to the rail that separated the jury from the rest of the courtroom.
Well, I'm glad that my learned colleague has already conceded that Luke Chardine had no motive for killing Deputy Bates. So who is Luke Chardine? He owns Two Crown Ranch. He's an employer who is well-respected by the men who work for him. He's done business in this town for the last 3 years, and during that time has earned the respect and admiration of his fellow citizens. And before that, he was a seaman, and not an ordinary seaman, but a ship's officer, who, when his captain was swept overboard during a typhoon, assumed command of the vessel and brought his ship safely into port, saving 28 lives. Now let us look more closely at the prosecutor's contention that all Sheriff Farrell and Deputy Bates wanted to do was question Mr. Chardine. Now if that is true, then what were Farrell and Bates doing asking such questions in Pueblo County in the first place? They are both from Bent County. They have no business questioning anyone in Pueblo County. If they had a suspect they needed to question who happened to be out of their jurisdiction, then the correct procedure would have been to first contact Sheriff John McKenzie and to ask that a deputy go with them. That's the way it's supposed to be. But they didn't do that. And Sheriff McKenzie is prepared to testify that he was never contacted. Well, that means Sheriff Farrell has no corroboration for his story.
There was very little cross-examination during the trial. Farrell reiterated that all he and Bates wanted to do was question Luke, and Luke repeated his claim that the two men attempted to rob him. After their testimony, Murchison and Gilmore made their summation.
Prosecution says that they were two law officers who wanted only to question Mr. Chardine, but neither of them were wearing a badge, and both of them were wearing hoods over their faces.
Murchison walked back over to the defense table and reached down into a sack, then withdrew a piece of cloth. He spread the cloth out, then held it up before the jury. It was a hood with two eye holes. This was the first time the hood had been introduced as evidence.
Specifically this hood, which I found exactly where Mr. Chardine said it would be. Wearing a hood like this is hardly the way a couple of lawmen would stop a suspect for questioning. I'm going to ask you to do the right thing and find my client not guilty.
Murchison returned to the defense table to sit beside his client.
Mr. Prosecutor, your summation.
Gilmore stood, hitched up his trousers, then approached the jury box.
What it all boils down to is Luke Chardine's word against the word of Clay Farrell. On the surface, one man's word against another would balance the scales. But there are two things that tip the scales. One is the fact that Clay Farrell isn't just another citizen. He is a sworn officer of the law. And the other issue is the fact that we have a dead body. Deputy Brad Gates is dead, and we have the defendant's own admission that he shot and killed him. As to the hood, I've no doubt that Mr. Murchison found it where Luke said it would be. But that proves only that Luke put the hood there. It is my contention that he did just that to build his defense. Under the circumstances, I feel you can bring no verdict but guilty of murder in the first degree.
With the conclusion of the attorney's summation, the judge sent the jury to deliberate. They returned in just under an hour.
Has the jury reached a verdict?
We have, Your Honor.
Would you publish a verdict, please?
We find the defendant guilty of manslaughter in the second degree.
Yes. You were not given the option of finding for second-degree manslaughter. The charge was for murder.
Your Honor, you can take your choice. You can either accept the verdict of guilty of manslaughter in the second degree or not guilty of murder in the first degree.
Will the defendant approach the bench?
Luke moved up to stand before the judge.
You have been found guilty of manslaughter in the second degree. The maximum penalty for that charge is to be incarcerated for 48 months, and you are hereby sentenced to the maximum allowed by law. Sheriff, take charge of the prisoner. This court is adjourned.